I want to welcome all of you this afternoon to this talk by the author Lawrence Scanlon and the Faculty of Religious Studies. I'm Ellen Aitken, I'm Dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies, and it's our pleasure to be able to host this event together with the McConnell Foundation, which has helped in bringing Lawrence Scanlon to Montreal and to McGill, and with some partners at the Development and Alumni Research Alumni Relations Office, which is always interested in living generously. As I reflected on this, just briefly, because you're here to hear Mr. Scanlon, the themes of gift and the themes of living generously and of giving of oneself run through the world's religions. In fact, you could use that as the thematic for looking at the various of the world's religions, and that would give you a very great deal of traction to think about religious traditions and practices and expressions over time. At the same time, also, living generously is one of the main ways in which religions interact in the public sphere nowadays and enter into engagement in community life. And we think only of the many, many sort of faith-based interventions in society and in common life around the world. So it seems to me especially appropriate that we here in religious studies offer some hospitality to Lawrence Scanlon as he talks about his year of living generously and of what has grown out of this. So Lawrence Scanlon, as you may well know, is renowned for his writing books and articles in many different subject areas. And his most recent book is available from the McGill Bookstore, has set up a little stand in the lobby, and I'm sure you're available to sign books, too, after the talk. And I look forward to hearing from you about the various challenges and really creative impulses that came out of this experience for you. So welcome, and welcome to McGill.
I'm wondering if anybody knows who this fellow is. Anybody recognize that man? Yes. This is Andrew Carnegie. When one thinks about doing good in the world, looking after each other, there are basically three pillars. There are volunteers, part of civil society. There is government. And there is philanthropy. And when we think of philanthropy, we think of people with very deep pockets giving for the benefit of other people. Andrew Carnegie was the first of the great philanthropists. He was a man of the 19th century. He was a poor Scot. And he came here. He worked for the railroads, running telegraph messages. He started off at the very bottom. He worked his way up. He became an extremely rich man. He also became the face of philanthropy. And you can draw a line between him and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. I'm wondering if anybody knows what that line is. What is the connection between Andrew Carnegie and Warren Buffett? Why did Carnegie become a philanthropist? I put this to students earlier today at McGill, and people recognized Carnegie, but they had not heard of something called the Homestead Strike. In 1892, Carnegie goes off. He goes back to Scotland. He has a castle in Scotland, and he goes back to Scotland on a holiday, and he leaves control of his steel empire with his business partner, a man named Frick. Frick was also a self-made man, but he did not have the warmth of heart that Carnegie possessed. Carnegie said to Frick, and there was some labor unrest at this steel plant on the banks of the Monongahela River near Pittsburgh. Ah, yes, the student in the other class who knew him was from Pittsburgh. So she recognized Andrew Carnegie. But I see kindness in those eyes, and I think he was a kind man. He was kind in his bones. Well, what happened next was that when there was labor unrest, when there was a strike at this plant, Frick called in the Pinkertons. These were the hired thugs of the day. They came down the river on barges, all of them toting Winchester rifles. And the men of the plant, there were 4,000 men employed at the plant, they warned the Pinkertons not to get off those barges or there would be trouble. Both sides had rifles. It's not certain who fired the first shot, but shots were fired. In fact, there was a pitched battle that went on for 14 hours. And at the end of it, three people were dead, scores were wounded. This was one of the bloodiest moments in the history of American labor. Now, to his credit, Carnegie was mortified by this. And he called this the defining moment in his life. And from this moment, he decided he would give back. He became a philanthropist. And he wrote a book called The Gospel of Wealth, in which he said famously, "He who dies rich dies disgraced." He felt it was the obligation of the rich to give to those less fortunate. And I actually like the phrase less fortunate because fortune, luck, plays a huge role in whether we succeed or fail. The color of our skin, whether we were loved as children, whether there were books in our house, whether we had support from family and friends, whether we managed to get through our childhoods unscathed, all of these things contribute to our ability to succeed in life. And Carnegie recognized that fact. Some who came after did not. Rockefeller believed he was rich because he was chosen. He was divinely chosen to be a rich man. So there are basically three pillars for getting things done. And I think there is no one solution to getting the job done of helping the less fortunate. We can't expect people like Carnegie or the man who came after him, Bill Gates, to do it all. The question that I ask myself is there an obligation on the part of those who have deep pockets to give some of that money away? This man thinks there is an obligation. And he read Carnegie's book, The Gospel of Wealth, and he gave it to Warren Buffett. So Buffett and Gates together have formed an alliance. They have created the biggest charitable foundation the world has ever seen. And they do a lot of good work. But there's a problem. He is the tail that wags the dog. Gates has decided that HIV/AIDS is going to be one of his foci. That's going to be where he's going to put his dollars. Malaria is another one. But he is a man of such enormous wealth that an infrastructure has been set up to deal with that particular battle. And if he bores of it tomorrow, well, then too bad for the infrastructure. So there is, as far as I can see, way too much power invested in the hands of one or two people. The other problem is volunteers. Governments have pulled back from their responsibilities. It used to be that governments in this country felt that they did have a responsibility. Medicare was born out of that philosophy. And we have since pulled back and become much more like our American neighbors, disinclined to put tax dollars to the relief of the citizens who are at the so-called bottom. So then more falls to volunteers, but there's a problem with that too, because volunteerism is declining in this country. The same people are doing a lot of volunteer work for a number of different agencies. There's burnout. There's tremendous burnout. So as far as I can see, what's going to have to happen is that there has to be a grand coalition among those three parties. The deep pockets, the volunteers, community workers, social activists, and government. And so that involves putting pressure where there is no pressure. I'm going to tell you a bit about how this book came to be. I like the cover. It shows one hand giving and one hand receiving. And there's a kind of elegance and a simplicity to that image, the giver and the receiver. This book has its genesis in the death of my mother 6 years ago. I'm the oldest of eight children, and we debated ways to honor her memory. And what we came up with, because she was a nurse all her life, our idea was that we would create a scholarship in her name at the University of Toronto, a nursing scholarship. And we were pretty happy with that. And then I read about a man named Bloomberg, who decided he would also donate to the same school of nursing, except he donated $10 million. So, and then I began to read about Buffett and Gates and Carnegie, and it occurred to me that there was a kind of charity Olympics underway. I'm an old journalist, and my antennae went up. I thought, there's something going on here. And what it seems to me has happened is that as governments have pulled back, they've created a vacuum for mega-rich and rock stars. People are filling the vacuum as best they can. Sometimes when I give these talks, I won't do it today because I might hurt some of you, but what I do is I reach into my bag. I've got a bag of Werther's caramel candies in this bag, and I toss them out to the audience. And I ask them to observe what happened, and what I want them to realize is that some of you got a candy and some of you didn't. This is the problem with philanthropy, is that there is no one ensuring that everybody gets a little bit. A philanthropist of Bill Gates' wealth is able to pick and choose, but nobody's saying, but wait a minute, Bill, that guy didn't get any. Well, governments, flawed though they may be, are best equipped to ensure that everybody gets a little. I'm going to take you on a little journey. This book is about me trying to come to grips with these major questions. The biggest one for me is, how do we bridge the gap between the poor and the rich? There has always been that gap, but some might argue that the gap is greater now than it has ever been. There are something like 1,000 billionaires in the world. And there are billions of people who live on a dollar a day. And I would argue that when that gap is allowed to exist, it's dangerous. It's volatile. What's happening in the Middle East right now is in part about a great many unemployed men who have been unemployed a long time and are very angry. It's about families who know full well that their relatives have been imprisoned unfairly. It's about a desire for civil society and freedom. They're fed up with their dictatorships, but it's also about poverty. It's about that gap. Carnegie knew about it. One of the impulses behind Carnegie was they saw revolution happening all around them, and they knew that when the gap is allowed to coexist, you have to let off a little bit of steam. You have to give a little back, or there's going to be revolution. So what's happening in the Middle East right now, I would argue, is in part about poverty. So that's my big question. How do we bridge the gap between the rich and the poor without infringing on people's freedoms? Communism has been tried and it didn't work all that well. But what about socialism? Will a social democracy work? So anyway, let's head off on my journey. I decided that I was going to pick 12 charities or NGOs, and I would try to answer these questions about bridging the gap between rich and poor. What can I do? Is there anything that I can do to make the world a better place, even in my own small way? So I picked 12 different charities or NGOs. Some were far afield, some quite close by. Now, this shot was taken at a place that I call Vinnie's. I live in Kingston, Ontario. I'm a middle-class person. I don't seem to lack for much. But 10 minutes from my house is Vinnie's. And Vinnie's is, I will use the word soup kitchen to describe what it is, but Thelma would be angry with me if she heard me use that word. Thelma is a woman on a disability pension. She makes $6,500 a year, but she volunteers every single day at Vinnie's. She comes at 8:30 in the morning, prepares food for lunch, serves lunch, does dishes. Vinnie's is her life. Deb is the administrator, and Jen is the cook. So this is 10 minutes from my house. Any of you who have been to Kingston will know that Princess Street is the great dividing line. If you live north of Princess, you're poor. If you live south of Princess, you're well-to-do. It's a completely ridiculous dividing line, but there is some truth in it. So 10 minutes from my house is where every day about 80 people come, and they come for a good meal. They come for community. Many of them are underhoused in the way that Thelma is. And people like Thelma must choose every day between rent and food. If Thelma didn't have Vinnie's to eat her main meal at, then she'd be hungry. So this is a question that I've been posing to students today, and I posed it at the McConnell Foundation. What can we do to make life better for Thelma? Should there be a guaranteed annual income, as some have argued? Hugh Siegel, the Red Tory, the so-called Red Tory, has argued that there should be a guaranteed annual income. But does that mean we'll end up with a bunch of people pulling in $20,000 a year and not wanting to do anything else? I don't think so, but this was the argument that was put today at McGill when I broached this subject. So there is no easy solution to this problem, how to bridge the gap. Everything has got a problem with it. But I would say that we have to have this debate, and we're not having it. People like Thelma are right under the radar. Some of them have had terrifically difficult lives, terrible childhoods, sexual abuse, abusive relationships, rotten luck, and there's no other word for it. I feel very fortunate. When I spent time at Vinnie's, I came home every day grateful for where I lived, for what I had, and I wanted to do something to help these people. So anyway, that's my time at Vinnie's. The woman holding the microphone is Kathy Crowe. Kathy Crowe is a nurse, and she led a fairly ordinary life for many years. She worked at a clinic for a doctor, and at some point she became, and this is a new invention, maybe 20 years old, like the food bank, about 20 years old. She is now a street nurse. She helps people. These are all street people, except for this man in the glasses. She became very political. She said it's wonderful that people are volunteering at church-run shelters, they're volunteering at food banks, but where are the people going to the mayor's office and pounding on the table and insisting that governments go back to doing what they did before, and that is helping the less fortunate? They're not doing that anymore. She feels that government has a role in civil society, and I would agree. So this is February. It's pretty cold in Toronto in February, and part of my job as a volunteer, I volunteered with her organization, which is called the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee. It was a committee set up 12 years ago to deal with the crisis of homelessness in this country. Since then, it's gotten much better. Kathy and her compatriots have burned out. Kathy is doing some teaching now, but the TDRC barely exists. They grew weary of the battle. It's just an onslaught trying to convince governments to open more shelters. The one issue that struck me most when I was at places like Vinnie's and with the TDRC was housing. The poor are underhoused or have no housing at all. Can anybody guess how many homeless people are in Canada? Anybody want to take a wild guess? How many? No, that's too high. Yeah. Well, it's 300,000. And the definition of poverty, the one that I like most, is if you spend more than 30% of your income on rent, you are poor. That number is between 5 and 8 million. So we're talking about extraordinary numbers of people for whom every day is a crisis. They don't know where they're going to eat the next meal, how they're going to get clothing for the winter, where they're going to sleep that night. So this has huge ramifications for us as a society. One student in a business class today at McGill pointed out that when I posed the question, what does this mean if you've got this many million? Well, it's a more volatile society. It's a more dangerous society. We have less security when we are surrounded by desperate people. Some in the U.S. live in gated communities where they think they are safe. But at some point, they have to leave those gated communities. They have to go outside their communities. So there's a certain amount of self-interest, I think, involved in creating a more equal society. Some of you may know a book called The Spirit Level. It came out, you've done some good reading, came out in 2009. The subhead is Why More Equal Societies Always Do Better. So this is a book produced by two British epidemiologists. If you don't know what that is, these are people who look at disease patterns from a great height. They looked at 12 different indicators of human health and happiness. Neonatal death rates, illiteracy, teenage pregnancy, obesity, levels of violence on the street, levels of incarceration, 12 different indicators. And they went back into the records for 50 years. They looked at all Western societies, and they wanted to know which societies do a better job of sharing. Can anybody suggest who did well on this survey?
Scandinavians and Japan.
You're not allowed to answer any more questions.
But I have read the book.
You're just a smarty pants. No. All right. That is absolutely correct. Now, further to my point that there are no perfect solutions, the Japanese also have a very high suicide rate, and the Scandinavians have a huge problem with alcohol. Now, it doesn't mean that this study is not worth anything. It's just to say that we can say that they are happy given these 12 indicators, but it's not the perfect solution, but I like the sound of it. They have decided, as societies, to share the wealth. We, I'm afraid, heavily influenced by our American neighbors and the Tea Party phenomenon, we now believe that taxes is a bad word, possibly because tax dollars are so foolishly spent. Sometimes tax dollars are spent in keeping governments in power, and that puts everybody off taxes. But I would argue that until we find a better solution, taxes just might be it. So this is March, my year of living generously, and I'm working at Hospice Kingston. This is another drop-in program. Annie Dillard, the great American writer, says, we're all dying, we're just dying at a different pace. Some of us know we're going to die very soon. That's true of these people. These people have been told they have a terminal illness, and this is a program meant to take their mind off things. They play euchre, we have a nice lunch. This woman on the right is, I think she's a nursing student from Queens. I found it mind-boggling that university students would consider as a volunteer effort Hospice Kingston, hanging out with old, not old necessarily, but dying people. And again, a certain amount of self-interest. She's a nursing student. It looks good on her resume. But when you ask these young students why they come to this kind of thing, they say, I've come for the wisdom. I come for the sense of community I feel here. I don't know what you think of students. Students in Kingston, where I live, have a terrible reputation. They're party animals. They're brats. They're loud. And there was, a month ago, a conference at Queen's on philanthropy run by students. 80 of the most remarkable young people I have ever met in my life. They were just busting to get out. They wanted to go far afield. They wanted to make a difference. They were amazing. So students will surprise. This is ISCA, Immigrant Services, and I'm doing things like teaching a young woman from Cape Verde how to drive. I'm doing ESL classes. I'm doing whatever I can to make life a little more tolerable for people who are new to this country. So now I'm in Costa Rica, San Jose, Costa Rica. I'm actually in a town outside of San Jose. The man on the right, your right, is Orlando Navarro. He is an ex-priest. For 25 years, he was a priest. And he wanted to do something for the desperately poor in his country of Costa Rica. And the worst of the worst off are people with HIV/AIDS. This man does not have AIDS. He has a problem with addiction. And Orlando, who's a very smart guy, believes that the way for this man to heal himself is to tell his story over and over again. And it struck me at first as an incredibly naive notion until I came back to Canada and I spoke to psychologists who said there's absolute truth in that. This man may have to tell his story 100 times, but maybe on the 101st telling, he will say to himself, and he's addicted because, he says, his wife died and he cannot get over the loss of his wife. So he drinks as a kind of self-medicating process. But Orlando thinks that after 101, maybe 201 tellings, he will finally say, because Orlando has listened to him. And that's the problem with, to come back to the poor in this country, nobody's listening to the poor. And one thing we can all do, we can do tiny, tiny things, and that might be on the street, spend some time with somebody who is a street person. And you don't have to give them money. There's lots of arguments against giving those people money, but talk to them. Grant them some dignity. And that's what Orlando is doing with this man. So one of the, I think, good things about the volunteering work that I did is that it takes me out of my comfort zones. I had never spent any time with sex trade workers or with transvestites. This woman is a sex trade worker. She arrives in Costa Rica. She was actually born there, then went to New York, got into a little difficulty with some drugs, was extradited to Costa Rica, and lands in her home country, but with no means of support. She sells the only thing she has to sell, and that's her body. And it's a great tragedy because her name is Yancy. She's a very smart woman, absolutely fluent in English and Spanish. She was my translator when I was there. She's doing pretty well now, but she's been through a hard go. And what my time at this NGO is called Hogar de la Esperanza. It means place of hope, and it's supported by an NGO based in Cobourg, Ontario, called Horizons of Friendship. This is my wife, Ulrika, here. This man was a transvestite. He worked on the stage. He's a lovely man. All of these people have HIV/AIDS. Some just had bad luck. Some got the virus by doing sex trade work. But what I like about the photograph is they look happy right now, at least for this moment. There is some sense of community there. There are 28 people at this facility. Orlando convinced the bishop to give him an acre of land right next to the seminary in San Jose. And using funds that he managed to acquire from, he just hit up all his friends. And they built this shelter. It accommodates 28 people. And if it wasn't there, then these people would be on the street. This is Javier, and he has reason to be sad. One thing I want to point out is that he has no... Many of the people at Hogar had a string around their necks, and on the end of the string would be a key. The key would be to a little bunkie where they had their, I don't know, the shampoo, their brushes. They had really virtually nothing. Javier had no money even to buy a key. Javier worked at a hotel offering massages to tourists, Canadian, American, and then it went from there to a lot more, and pretty soon he had the virus, and he has not told his wife and two daughters that he has the virus, and Orlando has said, you must tell them, or I will, and if you don't tell them, then you'll be asked to leave Hogar. So that accounts for the look on his face. This is a little boy I'm holding. His name is Carlitos, Charlie. Mirna, the woman you saw over here just a few slides ago, that's his son. And one of the difficulties of Hogar is that you've got 28 people who have never had any feel, any taste of community living, cooperative living. So who's doing the dishes? Who's cleaning the bathroom? These are all, they are points of disagreement. And Carlitos kept all of us light because Carlitos, he just wanted to kick a soccer ball all the time. So he was always kicking soccer balls at our heads. And it would hit one of us at the most inopportune moment, but it kept us all light and focused. This is one of the success stories. This is Mario. Mario arrived at Hogar weighing 50 pounds. He came to the center to die. But he regained his health. These retroviral drugs are really quite amazing. He learned English, and he got a nursing degree. So he is now an ambassador for Hogar. When there are conferences elsewhere in Central America, they send Mario. This is Jonathan. Jonathan is my favorite guy there. He is a man who did work in advertising. He was in commercials on TV. Very handsome, very congenial guy, but he decided he would make a little money on the side, turning tricks, and that led to the virus. Jonathan believes that people at the at Hogar should do more work, that work in work is salvation, and I have to agree with him. I think that work is good, and so he gave me a job of painting this security door a red. So that was my job that day, is painting. This is Jimmy. Jimmy is from the Caribbean, and Jimmy is pointing out some of the plants he grows. He drinks an awful onion-based concoction that he thinks is the clue to his robust health, and he looks the picture of health. And he's pointing out to Ulrika which plants he grows. Sometimes generosity is of the short-lived variety. This is a dog called Venus, or Venus, as they said in Spanish. This is the family where we stayed. And this dog, female, when she was still quite young, two young kittens were introduced into the household. And for 3 months, Venus suckled those kittens. And then the kittens grew up to be cats, and then they fought like cats and dogs. So sometimes, so Venus is a metaphor for generosity of the short-lived kind. One of the hardest volunteer experiences for me was working inside the prisons, because there is a tension inside prisons. It's sexual tension in part. It's also the tension between guards and convicts. This is the Olympiad. Every July, developmentally challenged young adults are brought to, this is inside Collins Bay Penitentiary in Kingston. And these athletes are brought for various races, sprints. This is the 100-yard dash. My job, that's me back there. My Irish blood means I'm no good in the sun, so I cover up. And I was the starter for the 100-yard dash. And it was really a lot of fun. But back to the business of tension inside prisons. There was a man I interviewed as part of the chapter, this chapter of the book. His name is Jerome. And Jerome did 25 years in Collins Bay, and he's doing fine now. He met a psychologist named Louise Gambora. She has a role in a TV program called Canada's Worst Driver, if anybody watches that program. Nobody watches that program? Good. This psychologist said to Jerome, I think that you could make something of yourself. You should set three goals for yourself. What are they? So Jerome said, well, I'd like to become a good coach in sports. I'd like to learn how to play the guitar. And I would like to work with the developmentally challenged. He did all of those things. And Jerome told me a story about the relationship he had with a particular guard. If inside the prison a guard shows any sort of compassion towards a convict, then that guard is a con lover, and he may find his tires slashed. And if the convict shows any human feeling for a guard, then that convict is a snitch, and he may find a shank in his back one morning. So the rules of the game don't allow for any sort of kinship between the two sides. But sometimes Jerome, who had some medical issues, would be driven to a clinic or a hospital by this guard, and then all the rules were changed. They could be buddies. They'd go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, get a tub of chicken, and have it at their leisure and just talk to each other as friends do. And they could do that outside. They couldn't do it inside. And when the guard died, the guard who liked his beer, Jerome went. He couldn't go to the funeral because the guards wouldn't have liked that. So after everybody left, this ex-convict went to the grave of the guard and poured a can of beer on the grave because the guard liked his beer. So for me, it's a metaphor about engagement and how there are two sides. There's the rich and the poor, and when there's no contact between them, then there can be no sense of sort of civic engagement. I tell the story in the book of my father. My father was 83 years old. He died about a year and a half ago. He had reason to be bitter and angry. He was living in an old folks' home. He had one leg. He had diabetes, so they took off his leg below the knee, and that didn't heal, so they took it off above the knee. His wife, his beloved wife, had died 6 years beforehand. So you would think he'd have reason to be upset. In fact, this was the happiest time of his life because he was so powerfully engaged with his community, which was a nursing home. He helped launch a newsletter. He was the only of several hundred people in this nursing home, the only one who virtually ran an office out of his bedroom. He had a printer. He had a computer. He had a tape recorder. He said, "I have the best job in the world. I'm writing obits in an old folks' home. I never lack for material." So he had reinvented himself as a journalist at the age of 83. He was engaged. And it's never too late to be engaged. And I told the business students here just a while ago that the subject of happiness has been exhaustively researched. And happiness does not lie in stuff. It's not the big house. It's not the big car. It is engagement. I think whatever happiness Bill Gates feels right now has to do not with his 40,000 square foot house, if that's what it is. It's with the fact that he is engaged with the world in a meaningful way. There's a professor, an American professor, who wrote a whole book on human happiness. He consulted all the studies, and they all said the same thing. The happiest people are those who give their money away, or their time. And you may find that hard to believe, but this is what they found. Real happiness is giving your money away. Scrooge knew that, right? Once a year, we celebrate the story of Scrooge. But it's a story that we should have in our heads all the time, because we need to be reminded that it's not about stuff. It's about engagement. Those of you who know me, and there are some old friends in the audience, they know I'm a horse person. I've written a lot of books about horses. This fellow is an autistic boy. His name is Caleb. And my job at this barn near Kingston was to help teach kids, able-bodied and challenged, to ride a horse. And so I helped tack up horses. I picked horses' feet. I just did whatever I could to make things easier for the woman who's running this place. The environment had to be one of my 12 volunteer experiences. So this is a man named Mark Matson, who is head of an organization in Ontario called Lake Ontario Waterkeeper. And part of their battle that year was defeating an incredibly stupid plan to burn tires as fuel in a cement kiln upwind of Kingston. Anyway, that was defeated by a lot of activists and by people like Mark Matson. This is my dog, Dusty. This book is dedicated to my dog. It simply says, "For Dusty Rose Scanlon," and we give her dates. One person I talked to at a meeting like this said, "I'm so sorry you lost the child." Well, no, Dusty Rose was my dog. I mean, it's a tragedy, but I didn't lose a child. A psychologist named Levinson coined the phrase pet therapy in 1969. So this volunteer experience was about me going to Onguinata, which is a facility in Kingston for profoundly physically challenged adults who do not communicate in the way that we do. They do not speak. So pet therapy means Dusty and I would just go to the place and just hang out with people and try to provoke some sort of just to stimulate them. make them feel a little more involved in their worlds. This is later in the year, and it's me down there. And I'm in New Orleans, and I'm building houses with Habitat for Humanity. Why they put me on a construction job, I don't know. I'm not all that handy, but I did what I could. That's me busting up some concrete over there. The house that we're standing in front of belongs to a woman named Miss Edna. And Miss Edna was really, really happy that Habitat had built her a house. But the question that she asked us is, not that she asked us, but her neighbors asked us, is, where's my house? Why is Miss Edna getting a house and I'm not getting a house? And this is one of the fatal flaws in the philanthropy model, the volunteering model. It's why I say governments have to be full participants in this, the three pillars. Because you end up with bad feelings because Miss Edna got helped. And this is St. Bernard Parish. This place was wiped out by the various hurricanes that came through here. There was nothing alive here. You see grass growing after the hurricanes, there was nothing. It was like a lunar landscape. So it's great. These people have come from all over Canada and the U.S. There's a place called Camp Hope down there where thousands of kids, it's like a kind of a reinvented Peace Corps where kids come down, college kids, high school kids, and they spend whole summers working there. So New Orleans has not been forgotten, but it was forgotten by the federal government. The U.S. federal government didn't do anywhere near what they should have to help these people. And so it's great that people volunteer and go down there, and we all felt pretty good about what we did, but that's not a reliable model for civil society, I don't think. Now I'm at this is Deseronto. It's a school for Aboriginal kids. These are mature students, actually. They're high school students trying to get their high school diplomas. And I'm trying to teach them. They've all got writer's block. This whisk-looking thing that this woman is holding is something I use when I ride my horse to get rid of insects. And this woman has been blindfolded, and she's allowed to touch the object and to pose questions to her fellow student. And together they'll come up with metaphors. Metaphors are basic building blocks for the writing process. And I'm trying to get them to get over their fear of coming up with metaphors. So this is Manoray FM. This is a FM radio station in Dakar, Senegal, West Africa. And earlier in my career, I spent some time working at CBC Radio. I was a producer. I'm supposed to know a few things about radio production. So I went to, with Canadian Crossroads International, I went to Dakar. This is a book written by Dominique Payet, who is the daughter of Lise Payet. Some of you will know her as a politician in this province. And her book is about radio journalism, and I used it. It was a useful tool. This is a women's radio station in a Muslim country, and they have very, very little funding. When the engineer wanted to talk with somebody live on the air, they would hammer on the glass. They had almost no equipment, and yet they produced some really, really good journalism. My task there was to go to story meetings in the morning and participate in that, and then critique the programming. Every noon for a half hour, they had their regular programming. Reporters would fan out into the city. And the main thing was to interview women, to make women a part of the dialogue in this country. And they haven't always been a part of that dialogue. So so that was my task at Manoray FM. This is Prisca. Prisca is a Christian in a country that is 90% Muslim. But the beautiful thing about Senegal is that they managed, the Christians and Muslims managed to coexist quite happily. They have made, as part of their regular routines, annually, daily, ways of sharing. So we stayed with a family in Dakar, and the doors were always open. Nobody knocked or called ahead. Neighbors, relatives just walked in, And if you happened to be eating a meal, it was expected that you would partake in that meal, which was a meal that was eaten communally, right? A big round plate. We sat all around it. And the woman who, these are her two boys, Parudu and Papi. Guy has to have playmates when he's volunteering, right? And this is their mother. So when we ate a meal, she would make sure that her kids and the guests got enough of the fish and the meat. So imagine a big bed of rice, maybe with the peanut butter sauce, and then she would actually, with her hands, make sure that we got enough. So I had to be okay with people touching my food, and that was fine. I thought it was a wonderful ritual. And also, we arrived in Dakar at Tabaski. Those of you who know your Bible or your Quran will know that Tabaski, well, as they call it in Senegal, it remembers that time in the Bible when Abraham was asked by God, as a test of his faith, to sacrifice his firstborn son. And just at the moment he's going to sacrifice his son on the altar, an angel or God, depending on which version you believe, intercedes and puts a sheep or a ram, and the ram is slaughtered. So Tabaski, when we arrived in Dakar after a long flight from Paris, there were probably 500,000 sheep in Dakar. And 2 days later, there were no sheep. So for 4 days, they gorged themselves on, I got really sick of lamb. But the beautiful thing is that they share with their Christian neighbors. And then at Thanksgiving and Christmas, when the Christians slaughter turkeys or chickens, they share with their Muslim neighbors. And there's a tradition in Dakar, once a year, you knock on the door of your neighbor and you beg forgiveness for any transgressions you may have committed during the previous year. So these are beautiful traditions, and most of us here don't know about them. So generosity will come up in the most amazing places where we don't expect them. Now, there's a very sad zoo in Dakar. And this chimpanzee, when he saw me, he thought that I would give him a banana, but I did not have a banana, and he was very angry with me. So he reached out of his cage, grabbed a clump of earth, and threw it at me. And 45 minutes later, he hadn't forgotten me. When I walked by that cage, he remembered me, and he was going to hit me again. So I might just stop there and look for questions, or I might just see. Yeah, let me just read. To give you a flavor of the book, there are three epigraphs at the beginning. One is from Mahatma Gandhi, who died in 1948. And he wrote, and by the way, I saw this on the wall at in New Orleans at Camp Hope. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. Plutarch was a Greek historian, biographer, philosopher who died in 120 AD. He said, an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. And finally, Jane Addams died in 1935, American civil rights activist, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, 1931. She said, the good we secure for ourselves is precarious and uncertain until it is secured for all of us and incorporated into our common life. So I guess my question is, can we agree that there is a moral obligation to share? Is there something, do the religions teach us that we should share what we have? And what does it mean to share? Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Is there an obligation?
There is a command to love your neighbor.
Does that mean sharing?
I would think. I think you can love somebody without at least sharing your lives somehow.
I think I remember talking to a man who had worked internationally for the Red Cross, the Canadian Red Cross. He'd worked all over the world in disaster zones. And I was getting very bleak one night talking about this problem of sharing wealth and why it isn't happening and all the hurdles. And he said, you mustn't think of trying to overcome that problem. He said, you must take it on a day-by-day, person-by-person basis. He said, you cannot solve world poverty, but you can help one other person who can help one other person. I have friends who have a big one-acre flower garden. People ask, well, what can I do? Well, there are so many things you can do, and you may think it's small, but it's not. It's never small. These people have a one-acre flower garden, and once a year, those of us who know them go out and cut flowers, and the money goes to Hospice Kingston. But all of their flowers go to the homes of people who are faced with terminal illnesses. The theory is called Flora Vita, Vitae, flowers for life. And the theory is that that bringing a little beauty into somebody's home when they're facing, well, one of the greatest issues we'll ever face, and that is our death, our own deaths, that this is something. This is something we can do for other people. Yeah, I think I'll stop there. I've yammered on enough. Do people have questions?
I'm just wondering how it felt for you. If I get this right, you spent a month at each place?
Yeah, now some of them...
And how did it feel to leave?
Yeah, that's a very... That's a very good question. Some of the volunteer experiences, by the nature of the setup, were light duty, I would say. Onguinata, the pet therapy one, that was just a few afternoons every week. Manoray FM, the radio station, in Dakar was 6 days a week, 9 hours a day. It was very, very intensive. And the question, this is why I think your question is a good one. The question is, how did you feel when you left? The question that they put to us, especially in Africa and Costa Rica, is, will you remember us? Are you just passing through, or will you stay somehow connected with us? And I think I've done a middling job of staying connected. About every 2 weeks, I go to my grocery store, and I buy about $20 worth of fresh fruit, and I go to Vinny's, because I know that they don't get any fresh fruit there. So that's my way of staying connected with Vinny's. Mirna, the woman in Costa Rica, the mother of Carlitos, her husband just died. So we'll be sending her some money. Manoray FM has really fallen on hard times, so they're going to need some help, and maybe I can be part of a fundraising campaign to get them out of debt and back on the air. Mirna in Costa Rica actually gave me a color photograph of Carlitos, and she wrote on the back in Spanish, so that you will never forget me. Lamine, whose photograph you saw, he was the man at the front holding the book. He has a one-hour program at Manoray FM on civil society. And Ulrika and I, my wife and I, went on the program. And he asked us, how do you stay connected? How are you going to keep us in your thoughts when you're an ocean away? Because these are truly dispossessed people, and they see all kinds of helpers and volunteers coming through, and we arrive, and wow, we're gung-ho, and then we go home, and we're swallowed up with our other lives. So it's a very, very valid question, and it's not an easy one to answer. How do you stay connected? You know, are you just passing through, or will we hear from you again? It's a very good question. I'm not sure I have the full answer.
In more beginning about what maybe we could do here and the homeless here. My husband has a friend that takes pictures of the homeless in Montreal, and he doesn't do it for money or anything like that. It's just a pleasure thing he does, like for taking pictures of him. And my husband went to see it. He had a photo of it a couple weeks ago. He said it was quite something to see, you know, how you could, you know, you see them on the street, but to actually, you know, to just see, it was almost like seeing their inside of their soul, sort of.
Right, right.
And they asked him, like, when you talked to them, you know, what to, you know, different things that they had said, and he said what you had said, that the one thing that they would like people to do is to talk to them, and when you talk to them, maybe if somebody gave them some money or food, that is to look them in the eye. That's,
yes.
Like people, when they say something, they say, okay, here you go, or I've got some food for you, do you want? But nobody ever looks them in the eye. They say, like, you know, we're people too. It's just maybe we're just part of our life a little bit. But he said that was a general thing that he said people from the street would say. But there were a few people that, by them talking, like you had said, you encountered, that it's just a little bit of listening and that from people, and then they sort of say, you know, someone's listened. And a few people, they really turn their life around. Maybe they've gone home, maybe gone back to school. And, you know, not everyone, but a few of them there, they turn their life around, got in touch with them and say, thank you so much. You know, I never would have done this without your help. And really, it was just a matter of saying a few words.
Yeah, so the question is about making contact with people on the street, the kinds of people who normally go around because they've got their hands out. I was in Montreal a year ago. I was helping somebody write a memoir, and I was staying at a B&B very close to here. And I was talking about this book, this project, and the man of the household said, well, you know, there's a homeless guy. He occupies the same corner all the time. And he said, maybe I could talk to him. And I said, ask him his name and just ask him how his day is going. Make some sort of, but it starts with his name. If you can know his name, then he becomes more of a human being for you. So I stayed there for two or three nights. And when I left, the man said, you know what? I did talk to that guy. And he's coming for dinner next week. So once he got his name, then the whole boogeyman thing diminished. He became a real person with a history, and they had coffee, and so the barrier came down. But it started with, you know, June Colwood, she was a great social activist. She said, even when we hold a door open for somebody, we change them in just a little way. We don't know. I mean, have you ever had this experience where somebody says, I remember you telling me 10 years ago, and I don't remember saying that, but we don't know who's listening when we speak. And I think the people I met, people at these soup kitchens and shelters, I was advised by a Kingston writer, Joanne Page, before going to Vinnie's. She had volunteered for many years at Vinnie's. She said, do not judge, do not patronize, and do not assume. And here I am writing a book about this, and I'm supposed to be having all of this in my head. And the one mistake I made repeatedly was assuming. I remember being in a church-run shelter in Toronto and meeting a young man wearing a checkered shirt. And I said to him, when you worked, where did you work? He said, I work today. I worked a full day today. I work every day. I just can't afford to pay rent and buy groceries. So I come to this shelter and I go to food banks. So we make assumptions about people. We assume, some of us, that the poor were always poor. In fact, many of the people I talked to had quite spectacular wealth. Here's what can happen. You get an illness like cancer. You begin to look for alternative therapies. They're not covered by drug plans or Medicare. Pretty soon, okay, does anybody know how much these drugs cost? It's unbelievable. So then you've sold your house, you sold your car. They don't work and you're on the street. I mean, it's the self-interest argument, I think, is powerful. Don't ever assume that because you're middle class and you're fairly well off now and you've got a good job, that your circumstances cannot change. That could be you. Don't ever think it can't be you. So the more we can make a society that is civil, that is that agrees that sharing what wealth we have is appropriate, that is the kind of society I want to live in. But it's not going to happen until we put pressure on politicians, so-called from above, and also from below. This is what's starting to happen. There are some really interesting things happening in the food bank and, food bank movement. There's one called Stop in Toronto, where they're actually teaching people how to eat in a healthy and cheaper fashion by vegetables. But these people don't know how to cook, so they're teaching them how to prepare food. So they're eating well. So I don't give up hope, but yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you can say more about political action, because I think one of the results of people getting involved at the personal level, which you've been talking about, is the result that, I mean, they begin to love and care for each other so much that they say, well, hey, you know, how come our government keeps cutting back in this area? How come they're putting mental patients on the street? How come they're building more prisons? How come they're buying more fighter jets? And I think a lot of people who work with those who are vulnerable do become politically active.
That's exactly right. But you have to get out of your comfort zone. You have to spend time
with these people, and I like your examples. Governments make choices all the time. Do we want a national housing program in this country, which we have not had since 1993, or do we want billion-dollar jets, $1 billion per jet? Do we need those jets? Do we need a national housing program? I would say yes, we desperately need a national housing program. That's what I heard over and over again when I talked to people on the street. If I can just get into decent housing, I can begin to address these terrible issues in my life, sometimes medication issues, self-medication issues, addiction issues. But it starts with housing. You have to give people a place to stay that allows them their dignity. And the poor have very, very little dignity. Back there.
Something you alluded to before, you know. I remember you saying something many years ago. It seemed to me that you had said, well, you know, just pick something and be involved in it. One thing, anyway. Perhaps it was Project PowShares or something.
I said that?
I think you did,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And now you're talking about a year with experiencing 12, you know, different charity programs. How did you get from 1 to 12? Is it a lifetime of adding on?
Well, I wrestled for a long time with how to frame this book. I knew I wanted to write a book about generosity, but it went through various shapes and structures until finally my agent said, why don't you write a book that is 12 volunteer experiences over 12 months? That gives a frame for it, that you can hang the narrative on that. So then the question was, which 12? And I have to say, there were some of the big-name disease charities didn't want me on board. Maybe they don't want a reporter hanging around for a month. Or there were also privacy issues. I got said no to a few times. So the 12 that I end up working with, they were fabulous because I said, I will show you what I write, and I will consider any of your objections, but I can't guarantee you anything. So that's the deal. And everybody was great. I mean, we fixed errors, but nobody tried to take over the project, and they had no agenda. So I'm very proud of the 12 that I picked. And in the book, I say, if you'd like to, you can find these people on the net, but if you can't, get in touch with me, and I'll connect you. I really believe in the work that all 12 do.
Oh, by the way, I didn't interpret you before to mean do only one.
Right.
Only one, but I think when I interpreted it to mean that when faced with so much need,
right.
I mean, pick something,
right.
And, you know.
Well, you know, in some provinces,
you have to do 40 hours of volunteer work, community work, before you get your high school diploma. And I really think that's a good idea, coming back to your point. Once you put people out into the field, if you can connect them with something that they can become passionate about, then that becomes part of their lives. I think we should all volunteer. I think it should be part of, like, civic duty. We don't force people to vote, and we won't force people to volunteer. But maybe there's some merit in insisting that be somehow part of our obligation. Maybe not force them, but I don't know what you do without forcing people's hands, but you have to, before you can get people engaged, they have to get out there. They have to be in touch with the people who need the help. There has to be a diminishing of that gap. Otherwise, there's no engagement. Yep.
Years ago, just down the street, there's a cathedral and a department store across the street, and I worked on the street for a year with the people who lived on the street. And one of the old fellows had this spot in front of the department store. He shared with me this bit of wisdom that he learned in his job, which was begging on the street. He got more money from the people who just walked by the church than from people heading in the other direction.
Mm.
He kind of assessed the crowd, and that was his observation that he gave.
Right. Yeah, good.
Any more questions? I'm just going to make sure that...
A lot of people have an inner desire to do some work, to help, to give. The problem comes in where do they go and who do they see?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they meet up with people who are disorganized. But in our lives, we go about finding work, finding jobs, finding spouses. And when it comes to doing benevolent work, sometimes it's, well, whatever comes to me, and we have to go out and look for that. We have to search out for that kind of work just as we would look for a job. There are organizations out there that need a lot of help, and they have a list of volunteers. I'm part of an organization that on a given day will have 180 people working. We're giving out food to 1,000 families a week. We have 3 or 4 trucks on the road. We have a warehouse. And now this all sounds huge, but just a few years ago it was almost ready to close. But it was reaching out. You spoke about the governments, and we need to get to the governments. Well, our organization has hooked up with 2 other major organizations in Montreal, and we've driven to Quebec City, and we sat down with them, and we said, Toronto's getting $28 a day. You're giving us $8 a day. What can you do? Well, we're up to $24, and we're still working.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting involved with the organizations and going out to meet them, visiting them on the websites, getting in touch, and then making that appointment. It's like if you're throwing a party, you invite people, and nobody shows up. You've got to call them, you've got to go and see them. And the organizations, too, have to get organized so that when people do come to their doorstep to work, they have to be ready to accept them and put them to work. I know some people have gone through our lines of working, and they come out crying because they said, finally, I can do something that makes a difference. And it starts out very small. Sometimes we think, well, we have to give $1 million or $100 million, but there are people out there who are looking for this development of trust. And I think that's the big thing, is that when we get names together, like our group is together with McGill on a certain function. But at first it was difficult because, well, we have a name to protect, and you have a name to protect, and, well, what's in it for you and what's in it for me? But through this dialogue, just as you have a dialogue with somebody who's on the street, there's a fellow that I say hello to, and I've given him one of our mission cards. And the other day, I didn't recognize him, and I walked by him, and he looked at me, and he waved at me.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something developing. I'm thinking, what's developing from this? And sometimes you get a little bit nervous and you go, well, no, this is what we're supposed to do, to communicate, to talk, to look them in the eye. But it's our job is to go out with that inner desire to research, to develop, to find out these missions just as you've done. And they're as close as a few blocks from here. They're a metro ride. It's when you take a metro ride down into these areas and you see people walking into the metro and they've got these little buggies with wheels on them, and the food's pouring out of it. And you say, wow, these people have stood in line for 3.5 hours to get 3 loaves of bread because there's 3 people in the family, all kinds of dry goods, etc. That's what keeps them going. We're getting the people off the street. We have 50 housing units. We have 32 apartments that are being built out of 6 apartments across the street. We feed 150 to 175 men every night and sleep them and send them out with a good breakfast in the morning. We have training programs. We can give them the food, but you have to give them the hope and give them the espoir to continue, and give them the tools of the trade, so to speak.
And all of that sounds fabulous, and I congratulate you. But I think that at least one part of that energy should go towards political heat. I think of what has been accomplished by other collective movements, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement. It often started with just people banding together and it moving out. I mean, on the one hand, it's so commendable what you're doing, but some of this should be properly the work of government. And it's not sustainable. When I look at the volunteer figures, I see that burnout is a huge, huge issue. You can just do the work for so long, and then you need new blood. You always have to have new blood. And I just think it's not fair that in a country with the wealth that we have, that structures aren't in place. Those of you who read about international development will know this metaphor. A man or woman are sitting on the bank of a river, hot summer day, and they're thinking about going in for a swim. And upstream comes a basket, and in the basket is a baby. And the woman or man goes out to the center of the river, gets the basket, pulls the baby to shore, and there's a great celebration because they've rescued this baby. But then another basket and another basket. And pretty soon all they're doing is rescuing babies, and nobody is asking the question, who is tossing babies in the river? There's a structural thing going on here. I told this story at a conference one time, and someone must have nodded off to sleep because she came up to me after my speech, and she was quite incensed. She said, who is throwing babies in the river? And I said, no, like, they're not actually throwing babies in the river. It's a metaphor. So, yeah. So that's the question that I think that we as a society have to ask. We're not literally throwing babies in the river, but in a way we are. Whenever we object to high taxes, I think, in effect, we're tossing babies. Whenever we say yes to governments when they say we're going to cut costs, and whenever I hear that, I know where the costs are going to be cut. They're not going to be cut up here. They're going to be cut down there. It's going to be fewer social workers, fewer playgrounds in inner-city neighborhoods. It's going to be the poor getting hit one more time. And I don't think it's sustainable. I think it's not morally defensible. And so, as I say, to come back to my first point, it's the three pillars, and they all have to be working together: volunteers, philanthropists, and government. And don't stop putting heat on government.
Did you find that which of the organizations you worked with were doing that effectively, or were they in any position to do that?
The Toronto Disaster Relief Committee certainly made political pressure a part of their campaign. They were table pounders. And foundations do wonderful work, but when you allow money to go into a foundation, the good news is the foundation may use it wisely. We hope they use it wisely. But if they don't, that's money that's been taken out of the public coffers. And in the U.S., they've looked at figures, something like $220 billion goes to foundations, and foundations are growing by the minute. Again, we hope they use the money wisely, but if they're not using it wisely, that is money that's been taken out of public coffers, which could have been designated. In a perfect world, it would be designated. There's something called the Tobin tax, which was invented by a Yale University prof in the time of Nixon, who was trying to stem cross-currency speculators who were playing havoc with world currencies. And he suggested putting an infinitesimal tax on money that crossed borders, the Tobin tax. If we did that, we would gain something like 25 cents on the $100, and at the end of the year, we'd have $40 billion. We would basically eradicate world poverty in a heartbeat, but all the countries would have to agree to it. We'd need somebody smart to govern the fund, somebody honest, a saint. So, again, there are no perfect solutions, but I'll wrap up right now with this story. The Dalai Lama was once asked by somebody who was embarking on a weekend retreat. He said, what should I focus on? I've got a weekend to think about things. What should I focus on? And he said, spend the first one-third thinking about compassion. Spend the next one-third thinking about compassion, and the next third thinking about compassion. This does not come easily to us. The first word I'm told in daycare centers that kids learn is mine, mine. So sharing doesn't always come easily. to us. But I think that our societies would be safer, happier, healthier if we could share. And I'll leave it to you to decide what is the best method for achieving that. It's a difficult problem, the problem of sharing wealth. But I think it's quite central to our time. So thank you.
Much for sharing this wealth in many ways.
Yeah.
And we wish you a great future, passion and generosity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. This will be, we're recording it for a podcast, which will be up on the